Hello, everybody. Welcome to the bonus episode. I'm very much afraid there is no Dominic. I was away on my travels last week, so you had Tabby and James with its incredible Asquith-themed discussion. And this week, Dominic is away on his travels. But fear not, we have an excellent, a top guest for you. But before I introduce him, just to remind you what is going on with all the various feeds. So you should have finished by now our Luther series. On Monday, you had our episode on the landings on the moon with special guest star Tom Hanks. And tomorrow, so that's Thursday, you're going to be having an episode on disco. So that's Dominic looking at his early research on America in the 70s. Tremendous stuff. And then next week, we have four parts on Lord Byron, marking the 200th anniversary of his death. So lots of stuff going on. But for now, in the absence of Dominic, I'm very happy to introduce basically the person without whom this would never have happened. We'd never have begun the podcast. You wouldn't be listening to me now. You wouldn't have all these episodes on Luther and Tom Hanks and disco and Byron or any of it, because that person is my brother, James Holland. Bro, hello.
Watch it, bro. I've got to say, that all sounds very salivating. I'm kind of into Luther. I've been to his house and definitely up for Byron. And obviously a gog at Tom Hanks, although I'm not going to lie, with a little bit of sort of green-eyed envy there, because we've been trying to get Tom Hanks on We Have Ways of Making You Talk for absolutely ages. I mean, he's the obvious go-to person if you want a kind of superstar celeb on your podcast and your subject is the Second World War. Tom Hanks is your go-to man. And yet he won't do it, but he will come on yours and talk about the moon.
Well, he loves the moon as well. He loves the moon.
He loves the moon. He loves the moon, typewriters, and a weird champagne cocktail.
And also, it has to be said, Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah, okay. That's his other thing. He has a non-alcoholic champagne cocktail, doesn't he?
Yeah, and the Beatles.
Okay, and the Beatles.
So there are quite an array of subjects.
Well, obviously, now that you've had such a lovely time with him, I'm sure he'll want to come back on and talk about the history of typewriters. And but preferably the Beatles. I mean, that would be something. When are you going to do a series on the Beatles?
Well, we've already done the Beatles.
Well, sort of.
And we did it, our episode on the Beatles, at the Chalk Valley History Festival, which you run, and which you could perhaps discuss a little later on in this episode.
I think you could go a little bit further than a one live recorded episode of Essence History on the Beatles.
Yeah, I agree.
I could do 12 parts.
But just also following up on the Tom Hanks theme, he has a series out at the moment, doesn't he, that he produced on Apple, Netflix?
Yes.
Called Masters of the Air, which is all about the American bombers in the Second World War. Apple TV.
You're sounding very engaged.
Well, I haven't seen it.
It's absolutely fantastic.
But we have some questions about it.
Okay.
That I will give you later on. But before we come to that, should we just talk about, I mean, because basically this is the origin myth.
The ultimate origin myth.
The ultimate origin myth. So Dominic and I have often discussed how the podcast came to start. We've done it loads of times. People still ask us. But this is pushing the envelope even further back. So as I've often said, we would never have done it if you hadn't begun We Have Ways of Making You Talk, the podcast you do with Al Murray about the Second World War. But how did you come to do that?
Well, I'll tell you that. But first of all, let me just tell you that how yours came about was because I was talking to our beloved friend and director and producer, Tony Pastor, owner of Goalhanger, and said, you really, really should talk to my brother. He'd be amazing at this because he knows everything there is to know. He's absolutely mine of information. He goes, yeah, okay, that is quite interesting. Yeah, maybe we could do a sort of generalist history podcast. I said, you should definitely talk to bro. Then he called you up and I called you up and said, look, I've just shamelessly said to Tony that you should do podcasts. And you were like, oh, I haven't got time to do podcasts. I can't be doing with that. I hate podcasts. I never listen to them. They're all awful. I said, honestly, bro, just go and have your lunch with Tony. And you did. And there you are.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was a gift horse. I was looking it in the mouth. What can I say?
You were looking in the mouth and you took it with both hands, realizing your early prejudices against podcasts were unfounded and unwarranted.
Yeah. Well, I put my hands up.
So that's how that came about. But how my one came about was because Tony is half Maltese. And although Tony and Goalhanger were originally set up with Gary Lineker to do sports programs, little sort of fill-ins and stuff and extra coverage of matches and all the rest of it, of football matches and so on and so forth, and little sports documentaries, he had been started to record Match of the Day podcast. And then he set up one with Gary and Danny Baker, which was very popular. about football. And he had also set up a cricket one with Broadie and Stephen Fry.
So this is Stuart Broad, for people who know nothing about cricket. Stuart Broad is a very brilliant England fast bowler.
Yes.
And Stephen Fry is a British national treasure.
Exactly. And anyway, so they were setting this up for the Ashes summer of 2019. For those who don't know what the Ashes is, it's the greatest cricketing clash between England and Australia, played out over the summer of 2019. And before that, Tony has said, oh, well, I'm doing this. So he's obviously thinking about expanding podcasts a little bit. And he had just been to Malta and he'd read what was my first history book, Fortress Malta, An Island Under Siege, which is all about Malta in the Second World War.
Yeah, brilliant book.
And I think he was aware of kind of other stuff I'd done. And he got in touch with my agent, Nick Hartwell, who he knew because he's a sports agent rather than a TV agent, really. And said, you know, how about James doing a Second World War podcast? And I said, well, yeah, you know, what's not to like?
So did you know about podcasts then?
Yeah.
So your instinct wasn't like mine to go, ugh.
No, it was bring it on.
Because you're just much more open.
Well, also, I'd done stuff with Dan, and Dan had also approached me.
So this is Dan Snow, History Hit.
Yeah, Dan Snow, History Hit. He'd asked me about doing a separate breakout podcast on the Second World War, following it week by week over the 5 years of the 5.5 years from September 1939 onwards to, I guess, 2025. Anyway, I can't quite remember why nothing came of that, but nothing came of that. And it all sort of happened all at the same sort of time. And Tony was in touch with me and then said, oh, well, who do you, you know, I think you should do it in conversation with someone. And both of us instinctively thought that doing it with another academic or another, you know, historian of the war was probably not a great idea. And I said, well, what about Al Murray? Because I knew him already and we used to meet up, you know, not entirely infrequently and have a few pints and basically talk about the war, about which he was enormously obsessed.
Al Murray, again, just to explain for people outside Britain, is a very, very famous comedian in Britain, best known for playing the part of a pub landlord.
Yes, which is his kind of sort of boorish kind of alter ego. But Al is also a very, very smart fellow and read history at Oxford and is obsessed with the Second World War, which is why we used to go and have beers and chew the cud. And I always kind of thought, well, having spoken to Tony, and I know that Tony felt exactly the same way, that a sort of conversational between two mates in a pub kind of vibe was the way forward. So coincidentally, I'd already got lunch booked with Al around that time. So when I saw him, I said, oh, how about it? And he just went, yeah, great. So it all kind of happened very, very quickly from that. And I remember we went to Soho House, as you do. And we said, well, what are we going to call it? And Al said, well, we're going to have to call it, we have ways of making you talk. But actually, that was a bit of an own goal, really, in retrospect, because we should have called it World War II Pod.
Or the rest is the Second World War.
Well, no, I think we should definitely not have called it that. I mean, I always get a bit annoyed about WW2 because it's the Americans that call it World War II and World War I. Literally everybody else calls it Second World War, whatever language it's in. And obviously the British call it Second World War.
Yeah, it's like one of those weird American things where they get the dates wrong.
Yeah.
So 1st of January, it's always January 1st, whatever.
Yeah.
Dominic and I have already complained to America about this.
Yeah.
They've ignored us.
Yeah, so months the wrong way around. So it's 9/11, but it should be 11/9.
Yeah, of course.
Etc.
We've already sorted this.
Yeah. Anyway, but I think, you know, we have to kind of bow to the great weight of influence that the United States has. And so we have now renamed it WW number 2 pod colon. We have ways of making you talk.
Oh, have you? In America?
Well, yeah, because if you search sort of Second World War podcasts or World War II podcasts, it doesn't come up.
Yes, of course.
It's crazy. So it's a very witty and clever play on words, but a bit too clever and witty for its own good.
Yeah. So that was launched when?
April 2019.
Okay.
And here we are, nearly 800 episodes in.
So basically you had a year before the lockdown happened.
Yeah.
And then the lockdown turbocharged it, didn't it?
Yes. Very much so. It was just fascinating. One of the things that's been really fascinating, and I know you have it as well, is the community that's built up around it. So we decided to call our membership club the Independent Company. And the Independent Company were the pathfinders of the British paratroopers that landed, first of all, in Normandy, at very early hours of 6th of June 1944, but also subsequently at Operation Market Garden when they landed at Arnhem. And so we decided to call our membership club the Independent Company, which then inevitably got shortened to IC.
Yeah.
And there are IC chapters all around the world, but also all throughout Britain. So there's a Dorset IC, there's the Northeast IC, there's the North American IC, and so on and so forth.
And you've had marriages, haven't you?
Well, with one marriage coming up, I mean, we're like sort of Cilla Black and Blind Date. It's amazing. We'll have to kind of think about what hat to wear.
So are you going to go to that?
Well, I don't know. If we do, I mean, you know, I'm sure we would.
In full combat gear.
It depends where it is with style and all the rest. I mean, for all I know, they're getting married in a chapel in Vegas or something.
Tank or something.
Yeah. But it's been lovely. And I think that a lot of people who found lockdown very difficult and isolating suddenly found they had this sort of community of like-minded people who were very obsessed with the Second World War.
Because I remember after the first lockdown, we went on holiday together to Cornwall.
Yep.
And we were desperate to go off to the beach. And he said, I've got to record a podcast. And I remember saying, why? I mean, honestly, come on. Have you got to?
You thought, what a wanker.
and then you kind of explained
yeah.
what it involved. Because at that point, I hadn't listened to it.
That's fine. I forgive you.
I hadn't listened to any podcast ever. I affected a tone of patrician hauteur to the whole thing.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, you did.
I know. It's a shameful. And I've learnt my lesson. And now I embrace new technological opportunities with open arms. At every opportunity. But I do remember you then kind of explaining just what it involved. And the rest is history.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's interesting because you and Dominic and obviously Rory and Alistair go off and sort of do the Royal Albert Hall and, you know, sell out tours of Australia and all the rest of it. We're sort of a bit difficult. We can't really do that because that's Al's other kind of professional life is touring theatres and doing live performances. And I think there's just too much crossover.
Yeah.
On his normal day job for us to start doing the same sort of thing with We Have Ways. But we do a festival.
When is it this year?
It's the 19th to the 21st of July. It's a place called Blackpen.
And that involves lots of people coming giving talks, but also loads of kit. So if you like tanks and, well, lorry, trucks.
Yeah, all of it, all the rest of it, but lots and lots of tanks, huge amounts of hardware. Also, we get really, really good living historians. So as I'm sure you know, the problem with living history is when it's, you know, people who are completely out of the wrong age group for the people that they're trying to portray. And you've got sort of slightly overweight 50-year-olds kind of trying to squeeze a medieval belt around their girth and all the rest of it. There's only so many Friar Tucks you can have. So it doesn't really kind of work. But the great thing about the guys we have is they're all really, they take it incredibly seriously. And they're all incredibly thin and young.
So obviously at the moment, there are all kinds of anxieties about the decline of troop numbers in the British Army. And indeed across Europe.
Well, so there you are. There you've got some extras.
So maybe, you know, if the balloon goes up,
yep,
they could answer the call, build a trench or something.
Yep, exactly. Roll out their Sherman tank, half track.
So not only is it a tremendous opportunity for anyone interested in the Second World War, but you're also doing your patriotic duty.
I'd like to think so, very much so, yeah.
So that's wonderful.
Well, yes. I mean, we can get onto all of that if you want to, but that's a whole different subject. But it's great fun. And it's a lovely sort of gathering of like-minded people. Everyone is universally lovely, I have to say. So we did the first one, I think, in 2021, I think. And it was just this terrific sort of coming together of people whose names you'd sort of seen on social media and in the sort of sidebar of shame during live streams and what have you. And there they all were. And it was just, it was absolutely fantastic. So it's become quite a thing.
So that's one live show that you do.
Yes.
But you're an absolute glutton for it because you also run Britain's leading history festival.
Yes.
So that for the past, what, 5-6 years has been in the village where we both grew up, Broadchalk,
yep,
outside Salisbury.
Since 2017, yeah. It's a bit more than that, actually.
And it used to be called the Chalk Valley History Festival. You've now rechristened it Chalk.
Yes. Well, you know, for many years, we had a media sponsor.
Was that a media sponsor that was not 100 miles away from employer of Dominic as a columnist?
The very same, the very same. And while that was a fruitful partnership in many ways, I don't think it's helpful for a history festival to have a title sponsor at all. And I certainly don't think it's helpful for a history festival to have a media title sponsor, whatever its political leaning.
Interesting, because, I mean, lots of literary festivals, certainly in Britain, it may be the same elsewhere, do have newspapers sponsoring them. But you think that that kind of muddies the kind of the neutrality?
Yeah, I do a bit. I mean, even though it didn't with us at all, in actual fact, it does in perception. And so it's been very liberating to be completely independent now. And so what I was very keen to do was have a rebrand and a kind of sort of reset and completely start again. And obviously what we can bring to the party this summer, because it's always the last week in June, is obviously 13 years of experience and growing expertise in how to put on a festival. But with everything else sort of shaken up quite considerably. And one of the things that really struck me last year when I was going around promoting one of my books was that I was on the program at various festivals around the country. And the program was basically the same, whether you were in Southern England or whether you're in the Midlands or whether you're in Northern England, whatever festival you were in, there were the same old people doing the same old talks. And if someone wanted to come and hear me talk, they could have done so in about a dozen different places. But what we're trying to do with Chalk now is make the whole program unique to Chalk. So I think the number of people that are standing up on their own and giving a talk about their book is literally you can count on one hand. You know, we've got something like 120 events and they're all curated and got brilliant people doing really thought-provoking stuff. And I'm really, really very keen for it to have a kind of creative cachet, kind of sort of thought leadership on how we view the past, and particularly the threads, I think, those threads that link what has been before with today and how we might think about the future as well. So it's not all kind of current affairs. It's not all kind of, you know, analysis of the war in Ukraine by any stretch of the imagination. But there are a lot of things which are kind of at the forefront of news at the moment, which we are looking at in a historical context, from kind of environment all the way through to obviously conflicts that are going around the world.
And just for those who haven't been to it or who might be tempted to come to it, I mean, it is incredibly beautiful setting.
It's an amazing setting.
Kind of beautiful rolling green hills, church in the background, all that.
Yep. Absolutely gorgeous. Amazing, amazing campsite. I mean, absolutely beautiful.
And it's the place where we used to go ghost hunting for the ghost of a Roman centurion.
Exactly.
So that's exciting as well.
So, you know, anyone who came, they might be able to spot him.
Yeah.
And actually, where we used to think he was is basically where the campsite is now. So you might just get him off. But
so that's exciting. And there's lots of people wandering around in medieval armor.
Yeah, all that. But we're very, very picky now about our living historians. I mean, we only get the best.
So living historians are people who dress up as people from the past and kind of live out. They have their little camps and things.
So there's reenactors who are trying to reenact a kind of moment in history.
So you've got them as well, haven't you?
Very few now. So they're more living historians. And the subtle difference is a living historian is someone who is a historian who is trying to learn from the process of doing.
So living historians are also kind of people who run Iron Age farms and things like that over the course of the year.
Exactly. And they now also rather grandly call themselves experimental archaeologists, which I quite like. I mean, it's a bit pretentious, but I do quite like it. But the guys we've got are really, really, really good. You know, they're absolute experts in their field.
So who's coming? I mean, if people come, what are they going to see?
Well, okay, let me give you one example. So one of the things we're doing is we're doing Courting Popularity, a cautionary tale from Hitler to Trump. And it's not really about Trump, it's about Hitler. It's looking how Hitler in the late 1920s and early 1930s gained popularity by taking on the law courts in Germany. And obviously, there are very obvious parallels with what's going on with Trump at the moment. And for that little panel, we've got Nicholas Frank, who is the son of Hans Frank, who was Hitler's lawyer, who was subsequently hanged at Nuremberg. We've got Jonathan Sumption. He's a very, very eminent barrister and member of the British Supreme Court.
And historian of the Hundred Years' War.
Yes, and historian as well. And also Frank McDonough, who is a historian, an academic specializing in the history of Nazi Germany. So, you know, that's a pretty salivating panel, I would say.
Absolutely. And do you have any leading podcasters coming?
Well, we do. We've got The Rest is History Live, which is very exciting.
Yeah, we have. And I know that Dominic in particular is really looking forward to that.
He's mustard keen, can't wait, because he loves festivals. But he's going to be in his very best behavior and smiling and charming everybody. You won't hear a whiff of peevishness.
No, I know. He just can't wait.
As he told Charlotte, our program director.
Yeah. I gather, yeah, the paper trail is very clear, I gather.
It is very long and extensive. Yeah. And irrefutable.
Yeah, so that's all very exciting. Brilliant. So that is the last week of June. So anyone who wants to come and see us, we'll be there.
Yes, and also, Brett, I mean, just while we're on it, I would urge anyone, I mean, you know, people listen to your podcast because you two make a fantastic double act and you're incredibly entertaining, but also presumably because they're interested in history. And if you're very interested in history and want to meet lots and lots of top, not just historians, but also thinkers and commentators. I mean, we've got the former president of Estonia coming, for example.
Yeah, very timely.
Yeah. So, you know, some proper kind of big cheeses.
All right.
But you get all the other stuff that you would expect from a English country festival in the middle of summer, with the camping and the beer and the drinks and the food and live music and all the rest of it. Razzmatazz.
Okay. So that's
24th to 30th of June. Chalkfestival.com.
Shall we just finish off by, we've got some questions for you about Masters of the Air, which is very timely because we've just had Tom Hanks on.
Yes.
So here we go. Did the Americans overestimate the B-17, which I guess is a plane, or underestimate the German defences. B-17 is a plane, is it?
Yes, so the B-17 is also known as a flying fortress. It's a four-engine heavy bomber, which can take about 2.5 tons of ordnance. And the idea was to arm these things to the hilt with 13 50-caliber machine guns. The caliber is the weight of the shot that comes out, the bullet that comes out. And what you would do is you'd fly them in a big formation. So imagine a sort of convoy of ships going across the Atlantic. It's the same principle, but sort of safety in numbers. The problem was that concept wasn't as secure as everyone thought. And what they realized very early on is that these bombers need to be escorted by fighter planes who could then see off other enemy fighter planes, because the biggest danger to a formation of flying fortresses, or indeed B-24 Liberators, which are similar four-engine bomber the Americans use, is not anti-aircraft guns firing from the ground. It is enemy fighter planes, single-engine and twin-engine fighter planes, who are faster and more agile and, you know, packed to the gunwales with armory. And so what you want to do is you need your own fighters to defend you and protect you against the enemy fighters. The problem was that one of the big directives was a directive called Point Blank, which was to make the priority to the destruction of the Luftwaffe, which is an inherently good idea, which was signed off at the beginning of June 1943. But while very conveniently, the industrial heartland of Germany was in the west of the country, which is very convenient if you're flying from very flat East Anglia in the east of the UK, most of the aircraft industry was much deeper into the Reich, particularly into the Southern Reich. And that was problematic because fighter planes at the time didn't have the range to escort those heavy bombers all the way. And the moment they tried to do it without fighter escort, they got absolutely decimated, very famously, or infamously, I should say, on the Schweinfurt-Regensburg raid on the 17th of August, and then again for a week of operations in October 1943.
So basically, it wasn't that they were overestimating the B-17 or underestimating the German defences, it was just that they were setting themselves impossible missions.
Basically, yes.
Right. Okay.
So they then need to do something dramatically about it, which was to improve the range of fighter aircraft, which they had done. They managed to do by the end of 1943. And thereafter, things improved dramatically for the Mighty Eighth, which was the main American Air Force operating out of Britain. There was also the 15th Air Force operating out of Italy at the same time.
So here is another very important question. Why were the swastikas painted on the side of some of the American planes next to the name?
So this indicates an enemy plane that they've shot down.
So that's a kind of tally.
A tally, yeah.
Okay. And what do you think of the portrayal of Anglo-American relations?
The only thing I didn't like was there's a scene in the pub where all the British are sort of slightly fey and sort of wimpy and get punched to the ground and say rather sort of snide, narky comments. I don't really think that was entirely representative. But what I don't have a problem with is focusing on the American part in this, because it's American-made, American-financed, and it's about an American bomb group, the 100th Bomb Group. You know, they're not making a film about the RAF, so you wouldn't expect them to have lots of Brits in it.
Okay, and of the three Second World War, World War II series that Tom Hanks has been involved in, so Band of Brothers, The Pacific, and Masters of the Air, which is your favourite, and why?
Well, I mean, all three of them are good. I mean, The Pacific is absolutely amazing. I think just because it was so exciting and so brilliant when it first came out, it's probably Band of Brothers. But I thought Masters of the Air was exceptional.
So you've seen the whole lot?
Yeah, obviously. It's absolutely amazing. And one of the things that's so amazing about Masters of the Air is because of the huge improvement in CGI, you could see the scale of which these bomber forces were going over to Nazi-occupied Europe.
So which year is it set?
Well, it's set between 1943 and 1945. So over 2 years. The first half of it is all set in the kind of, you know, first months of summer into the autumn of 1943, which was unquestionably the toughest time to be in a heavy bomb group and operating out of Britain. But the scale of all those fortresses flying over the skies of Europe, I mean, there's no other way you could see it or understand it in quite that way other than in the kind of sort of mastery of which it's portrayed in Masters of the Air. I mean, it gives you such a good impression. And I would say there's a couple of episodes in Masters of the Air which are better than anything in the previous two series. But if you're taking it as a whole, I'd go for Band of Brothers, but just because I'm nostalgic for it. Or sentimental.
Yeah, like I am about Jurassic Park.
Yes. Episode 5 of Masters of the Air is one of the best hours of television I've ever watched. And I would say it's the best 60 minutes of depiction of the Second World War that's ever been produced.
Well, let's hope Tom Hanks is listening to this. He'll be thrilled to hear that, maybe. Come on, we have ways.
So, bro, now it's my turn to ask you a question. And this comes from King Hamahamaha. What would have happened theologically and historically if Jesus wasn't crucified?
Well, we'd never have heard of him. There would be no Christianity.
There you are.
It's that easy. It's that simple.
Yep. And Matt Nell wants to know, who does at Tom Holland think Luther hated the most? Erasmus the Pope, the Zwickau prophets, or Andreas von Karlstadt?
Okay, so this is coming off the back of our series on Luther, which maybe lots of you listen to. I mean, Luther is a great hater, and his hatred operates on kind of various levels. It has various timbres. I think in some ways he ends up perhaps hating Karlstadt the most because his hatred is intermingled with respect and friendship. Maybe when you break up with someone you've been very close to, maybe that has a particular kind of depth and poignancy to it. But I guess, I mean, theologically speaking, the Pope, he sees the Pope as Antichrist, and you've got to hate Antichrist.
In a big way.
Yeah.
So, okay, well, I've got one for you, bro. And I know it's one that you've been asked a few times. But obviously, one of my problems when I'm doing my books and research is I'm just overwhelmed by the amount of primary sources. There's just so much, and you're always conscious every time you're going to put a book to bed that you've just, you know, literally scraped the top of it. But obviously, when you're doing ancient Rome, it's finite, or looking at the history of Carthage, it's decidedly finite. How do you kind of go about trying to piece it together? Do you just have to take a path through what you think is the most likely route?
It's a very different discipline. You are often panning for gold, and it's not just that you're looking for isolated fragments of information. Those fragments of information have to be placed in all kinds of contexts. You have to decide how reliable they are, what kind of framework they're appearing in, what broader framework those frameworks in turn have to be placed, how you are evaluating the various levels of evidence. And I think there's a sense in which the only way you can really do that is to just keep thinking about it. Because the more you think about it and the more you study it, hopefully the more nuanced your appreciation of how you should evaluate and present the evidence should be.
Which is why you're thinking about the Romans at least 10 times a day.
Yes, essentially. And of course, that then influences your broader sense of how you should interpret evidence from the past, which is why I hope it's not complete arrogance to cover the broad sweep of history that we do on the podcast. Because, I mean, in a way, as you say, the discipline required to study and write about ancient history and about modern history is very different, but I think complementary, which is why I think Dominic and I kind of different but complementary skill sets to periods that neither of us may have particularly studied.
I completely agree with that. And I think one of the things that's really exciting about podcasts and what you're doing, and also I'd like to think what we're doing, Al and I are doing on our Second World War podcast, is that, you know, until podcasts came along, your way of finding out about the past was quite limited. Of course, you could study it academically, but most ordinary punters haven't got the time or inclination to do that. And academic writing is often very dry and quite hard work to read through. So therefore, you're more likely to go to sort of popular narrative history, which, you know, is great, but you're still kind of piling your way through a 400, 500, 600 word page book, rather.
900 if written by Dominic, it has to be said.
900 if written by Dominic. So yes, big chunky books. Or you look at TV documentaries, which are inherently unsatisfactory because, you know, you're just scraping the top of the scrapings and never really getting any of the level of nuance that one really, really wants. Or you're reading historical fiction, which is problematic, or you're, you know, looking at films or playing computer games, all of which is problematic. What's really great about the podcast is that you can digest all the absolute latest academic thinking in a nuanced and digestible form. You know, whether it be a six-parter on the conquistadors or a four-parter on Carthage or six-parters on the Titanic or whatever, you can go into a level of detail which is entirely satisfactory without the kind of sweat of having to read through 600 or 900 pages. And you can feel a lot cleverer.
Well, Bray, that is very sweet of you. Very sweet of you.
No, but I mean, but we'd like to do the same thing on We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Yes. It's exactly the same thing. You know, if you're interested in the Second World War, there's actually a very, very limited way in which you can find out more without doing a deep academic dive.
Right. Or just to reiterate, you could go to your Second World War festival, and you want to just give the dates for that?
Yes, it's the 19th to the 21st of July.
And where is it?
It's near Silverstone.
Okay, so that's just outside London.
Or for all you history lovers out there, come to Chalk History Festival. which is the 24th to the 30th of June. There is so much to see and do. Amazing venues, amazing food, drink, fun, live music every single day. Incredible historians, thinkers, commentators.
And just to reiterate,
Rest is History Live.
Yeah, we will be there. Dominic and I will be there.
On Tuesday, the 25th of June.
Yeah, we haven't decided what we will be talking about, but we will be obviously talking about something historically themed.
Yep. And if anyone wants to find out more, you can look it up on chalkfestival.com. And I should just say that chalk has an E on the end, because it's the Chalk Valley where you and I brought up, bro. So it's Chalk Festival, chalkyfestival.com for all your Chalk History Festival needs.
Okay, well, I hope you've enjoyed that. Maybe see some of you either at the Second World War Festival or at Chalk, where Dominic and I, just to reiterate, will be. So thank you very much, bro. Thank you all for listening. Dominic will be back next week and we will see you then. Bye-bye.
Cheerio.